where policy meets politics, with Alveda King and Emmanuel Booth. Now, here's your hosts, Alveda King and Emmanuel Booth.
Hey, Emmanuel, Mama King, loving to get this information out to our listeners.
My name is Emmanuel Booth. Well, we're back here on Changing Community Broadcast, and we have our special guest here. We ask not what our community can do for us, but what we can do for our community. And Alveda King and Emmanuel Booth, welcome. Adam Cochran.
Yes, sir.
Well, you know what? I'm pretty good at saying Adam, so we'll call you Adam throughout the show.
Sounds good to me.
Okay. First of all, could you tell the audience about yourself? Who do you say Adam Cochran is?
So I'm the president of a company called Safe Kids, Inc., and what our mission is and what we say is we're creating a generation of safe thinkers. What we've done is created curriculum for in-classroom use by teachers to help teach kids what to do should violence find them.
Oh, wow. Okay, so you want to make children safe is what you were saying?
Exactly.
Okay, so how did you, what caused you to do that? What caused you want to get in that type of business?
So I was a police officer for a large number of years, and during that time I was teaching active shooter survival throughout the country, Southern California and all over. And I got asked a few years ago by a elementary school teacher, you know, Adam, we love your program, but I'm a third grade teacher, and I'm not really sure how I'm going to talk to my kids about your program. And then it dawned on me that we have kind of left America's children in this weird gap between when they start school to high school and even beyond. We talk about fire drills and earthquake drills out west and all these other drills that we do, stop, drop, and roll, but we've never talked to kids about what happens if violence has found them somewhere.
Wow. You know what, most of the listeners know my background. I was a deputy sheriff in Northwest Indiana, and my last assignment was to make sure that the courthouses were safe. And in doing it, active shooting the training. But the ironic thing is, growing up in the inner city, I grew up in Gary, Indiana, and shooting to school was just something that was a part of going to high school, which was, that was terrible. You go in and talk, how do you talk to children about violence, being that with the video games and television, how do you actually start talking to children about violence? And how early should you talk to them about violence?
So we believe we can start as early as kindergarten. And what we've done is created a curriculum that is teacher-focused. So it's really their teachers who are starting the conversation with them. And we do it through narrative and story. So it's storytelling, it's books, we use comic books in different parts of it. But the way that we open up the conversation, and even as a parent at home, is the first lesson of everything starts with who are people that hurt and who are people that help. And to start to have kids digest that there's people who help you in the world and there's people that may hurt you in the world. And we do it via a Venn diagram. And we talk about the people that meet in the middle, who are people who are sometimes helpful, but sometimes who are hurtful.
Okay, say for instance, it's the first day of school and a kid going to kindergarten. That's what you would tell them, when the first thing you would tell them when they enter kindergarten?
So the program and the way that we talk about wanting to use and start to talk to kids is the first day of kindergarten is scary for any kid. And so we probably, we talk about giving at that brand new introduction to the school, give them a couple of months to get situated, to find some friends, to start talking and get used to the fact they're getting lesson plans, to get used to the fact that they're learning math and English and that there's fire drill. So the same way you would start to work in a fire drill with them or like a natural disaster drill or something, this, you want to kind of work this into the same process.
Well, so, do you think video games influence children? They say the average kid spends at least 8 hours a week. I think it's a bit more on violent video games. Do you think that has an effect on our young people?
I think it has a desensitizing effect. I think the majority of children, and I grew up right at the very beginning of the video age. So we had Atari and Pac-Man and some of these other games. So we didn't necessarily have the shoot 'em up games. But I think it desensitizes. I know for me, I never equated the games that I were playing to actual real life or to real people. But now these games are so realistic. They're so the depth of graphics and sound, and now you can talk to your friends as you're playing. I think it's becoming a ground for, at the very least, training or getting kids in the mindset of, hey, this works and this doesn't work. Well, if I do this, oh, I got X amount of kills or X amount of points. But when I did this, you know, I died. And I think it's starting to become a training ground.
I think so. I was a young man. I was telling him that we were trying to get him away from the game. And so, you know, a lot of times you get take something away from a child, you try to give something. And we were playing chess, and he was doing a strategy called mapping. And he was so good at it. And I was like, well, what did you learn that from? I mean, he was killing me in chess. I'm a pretty good chess player. He said, well, I learned it from Call of Duty. And I talked to some of my tactical guys, and I'm saying just from a tactical perspective is I think they're getting great tactical training from these video games. And so I guess if you would go to an active shooter situation, you hear there's a kid in there, you would take that lot more lightly than, you know, someone that's actually had some type of tactical training. What do you think?
Yeah, I think you're definitely on the right track. And it's even becoming so far as the weapons that you choose in these games, the way you manipulate them and the way that you use them is the same as in real life. So whereas, you know, when you're first learning to use an assault weapon in the military or law enforcement or a shotgun or some of these other weapons, there's a learning curve behind how they work. Well, these games now are so realistic that the way the nomenclature works is actually built into the game. So you're going beyond, you know, just learning the firearm, you're actually being able to manipulate it in the game and clearing malfunctions of that weapon. And I think it's pushing us further and further down the road to, if for some reason this kid switches from video games to real life, we've armed him, so to speak, with a little bit better knowledge of how to do this.
Well, you know, I remember going to, I won't name the name of the store where they sell these games, and I went in there one time, and I seen I'm getting off of work from the courts, and I go there, and I see all these kids in there getting this game. Some of them didn't look like they were racked too tight, and I'm not demonizing them, but they all had book bags. And I'm thinking, like, okay, first of all, I'm looking at the store owner. I wouldn't allow these book bags in there. I'm just being honest because I'm thinking, like, you know, what is going on? And it wasn't not too long after that someone did shoot up one of those places. And so my question is this. How do we prevent the slaughter of our children? How do you think we prevent it?
It's really a multiple-edged approach. I mean, there's not one silver bullet that's going to solve all the problems. And in law enforcement, we have a thing called the crime triangle, and it takes three parts to have a crime. You have to have the suspect, you know, the person who's going to commit the crime. You have to have a place where that crime is going to occur, and then you have to have the potential victims of that crime. If you take away any one of those three, you don't have a crime. You have a suspect and a place, but there's no victims. You can have a victim and a suspect, someone who may want to hurt people, but they're not together in the same place. And when we look at what we're doing currently, there's a lot behind the legislature to either legislate weapons or to legislate mental health and all these other things, which are definitely a component of the problem. Then you have companies that sell locks and fencing and security and cameras. And again, great. This is part of it as well, where we start to try to secure, or what we call target hardening, try to make this potential place much harder for this person to commit a crime at. But what we haven't really focused on is the victims. And what we haven't really focused on is allowing people not to be victimized and giving them some tools to be able to prevent and help themselves survive.
Okay, instead of just being a victim, you teach them actually. So let me ask you a question. What's the difference from a law enforcement aspect of training and dealing with active shooters? Because anyone in law enforcement know how we're taught to deal with active shooters, eliminate the threat. I mean, that's the priority that we have is to go in and eliminate the threat. So what would you, if it's an active shooter, what would you tell a child and what would you tell the teacher? First, what would you tell the teacher to do, and then what would you tell the child to do if there was an active shooter?
The program that we developed is called the HERO program, and HERO is an acronym for Hide, Escape, Run, and Overcome. And so what we say is, if you look at the body's natural responses, which is fight, flight, or freeze, when you have a bunch of adrenaline and stress that comes into your body, your body is going to naturally want to do one of these things. And so we're giving both teachers and students permission to run from these incidents, to escape a room. They may, you know, locking down in a room might not be the best course of action given what this person is doing. Overcoming, and that's everything from throwing your book bag and running to throwing sand to doing something to help increase your odds. This is where if you don't do anything, you know, certain harm is going to come to you. And when we tell teachers, you know, and the way that we talk to teachers is it's a coordinated effort. It's a team effort. You know, we've expected America's teachers to, by themselves, you know, on the worst day of their lives, be able to work like Navy SEALs and these, you know, military tacticians unarmed to save all of our kids and at the same time do the right thing and not get hurt. And that's a huge, daunting task. And we believe if we can start to create a team effort to where, you know, you're at a school and you hear maybe gunshots or screaming or there's a violent intruder who has come in the classroom, the teacher or the school campus, the teacher can yell, hide, hide, hide. And you have kids next to the door and they run up and they shut the door and, you know, they put a bunch of desks and chairs and they start to barricade the door as the teacher's, you know, pulling the window shades and turn off the lights as other students are finding their hiding places in the classroom during this lockdown. If we make a team effort behind it, it's going to increase our odds.
What do you think is bullying the cause of these school shootings? And then if so, what type of role do you think bullying play in the school shootings?
You know, I think bullying does play a large part. When we look at the history of shootings and we look all the way back to Columbine, a good chunk of school shootings have come from bullied kids, you know, the recipients of the bullying. And when we look at bullying, we can break it down into kind of three parts that to have a bully. You have to have a harmful intent, you know, someone who's doing it to be harmful to you, and whether it's words or physical. You have to have it repeated over and over and over again. But the more important part is there's an imbalance of power, meaning that the bully has the situational power over the person who is being bullied. And you know, the instant flip of power comes when you show up with a firearm or a knife or a bomb or whatever you want to bring to school to flip the scales of power. And I think a big part of some of these school shootings is coming from these kids who have been bullied. And instead of doing something along the way and intervention along the way, it's gotten to the point to where they feel the ultimate act of control and to flip power is to come in and hurt some people.
Well, you know what? I believe what you're saying is absolutely true. I'm just looking at I graduated from high school in like 1991. That'll kind of tell you my age. And I looked at how bullying was dealt with in my era. You know, we grew up watching Rocky. Okay, now I'm not advocating violence at school, but it was more one of those things that if you had a bully, okay. And he kept bothering you, then the guy, you know, you dealt with him. And I don't think it was as bad as it now, because we didn't have cyberbullying when we were growing up, you know. Mostly what we had was, you know, some guy thought he was going to take your lunch, and then you had to put a stop to it. But I can tell this story. I remember leaving a private school, going into the inner city schools, and because at the time it seemed like the public school had a better sports program, and I'll never forget the gangs didn't like me, and they were trying to bully me, and I took some mace to school, and you know, they showed up, they surrounded me, and I got kicked out of school for it, you know. But when we went in, because most children have this rule about this no snitch rule anyway, and so. Mm-hmm. My mom seen these gang of guys follow me. She said, what's going on? I couldn't lie to her, and I told her. So she goes to the principal and say, hey, he's bullying my son, which didn't go too well with the gangs, you know. So I said, I got to go back to school. On top of that, they're going to be waiting for me. And I'll never forget, I had a can of mace. And I'm just and at that time, if I would have had access to something else, I probably would have took that. I'm just being honest at that age. Being afraid, and I showed up, and when they showed up, I maced them, and then I figured that I was in the right, and I gave it to the principal, and so I can understand how that, what's the difference between the shootings that goes on in the inner city versus the ones that goes on in the suburbs?
Well, there's an escalation there. So, like you talked about, the average bully, hey, give me your lunch money, kid. Hey, you're ugly. With cyberbullying, it's a lot about impressions. And that's really not going to hurt you. I mean, that it might upset you. There might be some depression, anxiety, and everything around it. But the average bully has got no real teeth to do physical harm up to death. Whereas the same tactics when they're used by criminal gang members is a little bit different. Those guys will hurt you.
Right.
And it's that scale. And what's the in-between? Like you said, you brought mace with you as a self-defense tactic. Probably not a bad idea for you at that time, and it might have saved you from further harm, potentially, because you knew what was happening. But I would be willing to bet it never crossed your mind to maybe go to the school to the teachers or the principal and say, hey, I'm in fear of my life here. These gangsters are waiting for me. Kids just don't do that.
Yeah, it's not acceptable. That's just not acceptable because then you create more in that environment, and it probably hasn't changed much. And in that environment now, you create, it's going to get worse for you once you do that. And
right.
And then when we're looking at the culture, and I thought about, you know, even, you know, as I progressed in high school and progressed in, as an athlete, and so it got to the point of, well, they can't beat us anymore. So I'll never forget this. Me and my brothers were wrestlers, and we did real well and played football. And so we all the athletes kind of like stuck together. Now, we weren't bullying people, but then you had the gangs, okay? And so the gangs didn't like us, so it was nothing they could do. And I'll never forget this. The gang members was talking some stuff, and I said, well, you know what, we're going to shut them up. We tired of them anyway, you know. We go towards him. He pulls out a gun and pow, point blank range, and he shoots at us. Now, here's the dynamic that goes on there in the inner city. He shoots at us, so the average person would say the rational thing to do is tell your parents, tell the principal, right, that you're being shot at. Me, being the oldest guy and people looked up to me, they said, well, you're going to have to do something about it. Now, this is the rest of the people talking to me said, well, you know, he shot at you, you're going to have to do something. But whatever you do, don't tell your parents. And what we're saying is this stuff needed to be, and we're talking about in the 89-90 era, mm-hmm. That should have been reported even then. And so they were putting pressure on me and said, well, he shot at you. Now, we're talking about the other city, and they're saying, well, he shot at you. The only one thing left for you to do to him, you got to get a gun. And fortunately, by the grace of God, I didn't succumb to that peer pressure to do that, to retaliate. And I end up, you know what, I said, forget it. I told him, and he ended up getting arrested. But at the time, the peer pressure was, no, we cannot tell. We have to handle these things ourselves. And so I'm just imagining how it is today with the cyberbullying, but you're right, it's two different bullies. These gangs would actually cause you bodily harm. You get an argument, these guys pull out a gun, but then even then it was not acceptable to report this. And so how do we get our children to and I had a lot of policemen in my family, you know, so when I told them, you know, but how do we get our children to start, if they're being bullied, to report it so it don't get to that till they start trying to take things in their own hands?
In my opinion, we have to keep it open and honest, but also have the ability to do it through multiple channels. So, I mean, some kids are shy to begin with, and if they're being picked on, they're probably barely talk to their parents, no less teachers or administrators or counselors. A lot of schools are moving to a text-based reporting system to where kids can text it in, they can social media it in.
Okay,
in some instances, it can be anonymous, so that way. And so let's say you're not the one being bullied, but you're watching, you know, this other child being bullied by a couple people, and you're like, well, I'm not really the kind of step into this. This is not really my problem. But I can text in, hey, Jimmy is picking on, you know, Frank and Freddie. And so that way the school can start to observe and watch what's going on. I know there's also coordinated efforts in some school districts. So the teachers who see the kids in the classroom, usually on the best behavior because you're in front of a teacher, coordinate with the supervisors that are at recess or at lunch, because it's those folks that are seeing a lot of the bullying and the picking on when you're not under direct supervision. Now, if we can start a communication within the school to piece together that, hey, you know, I know this Jimmy eats by himself and Frank and Freddie come over all the time, and it looks like there may be bullying, and in the classroom they sit completely apart from each other, we can start to pick up on signs just on our own to realize something might be wrong here.
Wow. I mean, that's just awesome, because I wish they had that when we were growing up, you know, the deal with that. And so have you, as you went into the schools now, what do you think about it? Do you think there should be someone armed at schools now at all times, or what do you think about that?
You know, I think history repeats itself, and as we were doing research as we developed the program, we noticed that the last time that students were killed in a fire in school was in the late 50s in Chicago. Mm. And we have to assume that at that time, when school fires were taking the lives of children, not necessarily people with guns or knives, were they having these same conversations? Should we put a firefighter in every classroom? Should we put fire hoses in fire trucks? What should we do? Well, time has told us we have fire drills and sprinklers in the ceiling and fire retardant furniture, and we do fire drills, and we found the way around it. And I think the same is going to hold true in 50 years from now when we look at this problem. So we put police officers in every school. Some school districts are removing their school resource officers because they feel it's giving a bad impression to students about the police. You have people that say, yeah, let's arm our educators, and you have others that say, we don't want guns anywhere near our schools. I don't think it's a solid yes or no. I think in some schools it makes sense, especially very rural areas. I know parts of California, Nevada, Arizona, where your closest police officer is 45 or 50 minutes away. They keep weapons on campus, not only for the animals and the bears and the things that would walk through campus just naturally from where they're at, but also to help potentially deal with a situation where they're well-trained, because they know the police aren't coming for maybe an hour, depending on when it is. And that's a long time to try to deal with someone that may potentially have a weapon. Whereas inner city, highly urbanized areas, those are areas that maybe it doesn't make quite as much sense. I think it's an individual decision, but more importantly, the person that would be carrying that firearm, we need to look at, and what I ask educators is, are you prepared mentally to have to take the life of one of your students if it ends up being a student or a former student? And there's a lot around it, and I just don't think there's one fail-safe solution, but I think it can be appropriate depending on the circumstance.
Wow. Well, I think that, you know, if you look at a place like Chicago, you look at, a lot of the inner cities, because of the gangs and the shootings, a lot of them have police there. I mean, that they, and the resource mm-hmm. officers there, and then they have, I mean, actually pretty large in a lot of the urban communities. They got pretty large police departments within the, police academy certified police officers actively in that because of the gangs and the violence. And so the question is, yes, I wonder how this nation is going to look in a couple of years from now, because that's going on now in the inner city. It's acceptable to walk into some high schools, to walk into them, and you have to go through metal detectors. It's gotten that bad, you know, and mm-hmm. so it's going to be pretty interesting to see what will happen in time with our school systems. And so you, what you're saying is that it's not a one-off fit all for each school. Is that correct?
Correct. Yeah. I mean, when you have, especially police officers on campus, it's a help, but as we saw at Columbine, there was a police officer on that campus who actually engaged them, Mr. Harris and Mr. Klebold, before they actually went into the school. So at the start, it's a help, but I think it really goes back to a team effort. I think if you have students who are on board with programs such as the HERO program or other programs, whatever the school has, on top of a layer of police officers and or armed or unarmed security, depending on the school, I think it's just these layers, and you want to make it as hard as possible for this suspect, this person, this, you know, soon-to-be criminal, to come in and hurt people at a place. You make the place a little bit stronger, you make the victims a little bit more resistant, and it's a team effort.
Wow. Do you think that sexual abuse is rampant in schools today?
You know, that's an interesting question, because we see it even most recently with the Olympic coach that has been convicted. The sexual assault that's really coming out throughout Hollywood. We're based out of California, so we're right in the thick of of the media and hearing about this out in our neck of the woods. But, you know, I think it starts somewhere. And from what we're seeing, it tends to start right about high school. And I think it's one of those naturally occurring, and when I say naturally occurring, it's when teenagers are their hormones are flowing and they're trying to figure out who they are and what they are. And it seems to be at that point is when these events are starting to occur where, guys and girls both are trying to figure themselves out. Now, as far as the sexual assault, it's never appropriate anytime, anywhere. And I think some people never get out of the kind of adolescent, where they feel that they can touch people or say things inappropriately. And I think now we're seeing it more than ever because people are speaking up. And obviously it needs to stop. And people are finally feeling empowered enough to speak up, to say something, to be taken seriously, so we can start to design programs as weird as this sounds, to design programs to tell people, no, it's not okay to touch people in this way, or it's not okay to say things in this way. And it might have to start right about the time that kids are so to speak, coming to age.
Wow, yeah, that's true. That's right. Once they come of age, then they need to be told this is what you should do and this is what you should not do, and this is not acceptable in society. I think that needs to be done. Well, I tell you what, we're coming to the end of this segment of Change Community Broadcast, and I want to thank you so much for coming on because this is very important, because if we're going to have change our community, it needs to be safe, you know, and we need to know that our children are safe. Thank you so much.
Great, thank you.
All right, well, that's going to end that segment. This won't be on. You know what? You should talk to our executive producer, Van. We're building the network. Talk to him about you actually having a show on the network in order to, you know, keep the people safe. It'll be video and all of that, but he's more like our technical guy. So if you have Van's number, Jerry Van's number?
I believe so, yeah. I was texting him this morning. Yeah. So, we've been going back and forth this morning. So, yeah, I'll reach out to him. This has been fantastic. Really good stuff.
It's kind of funny because when I'm looking at this, I'm looking like, oh, okay, this is right up my alley, you know, working in law enforcement and all that stuff all of those years and dealing with different type of people and things of that nature. So, yeah, make sure that you I'm going to tell him, I'm going to recommend that you get one, and then make sure that you talk to him because it's needed on the network. I mean, this will probably save lives with your teaching. And so thanks a lot and stay safe.
Thank you, sir. You do the same. We'll talk to you soon.
Thank you. Bye.
All right. Bye-bye.
Hey, Emmanuel. Mama King, loving to get this information out to our listeners.